I'd like to welcome everyone here today and to welcome Sir Geoffrey Hill, who has joined me for a conversation about W.B. Yeats and why Yeats. Let me make it clear to begin with that the Yeats is entirely my own suggestion and not Geoffrey's. But I wished really to talk with Geoffrey a little about some of the things that are issues, as we say, in reading a poet as major as Yeats, and yet a poet as problematic as Yeats is. And one of the things that I wished, I suppose, most to talk to Geoffrey about today is the whole concept of Yeats's self-revisings, changings over an extremely long and in many ways tortuously conceived poetic career. And to that end, really, I thought it might be useful if we looked at certain instances when Yeats's very texts were reconceived, rethought, rewritten. And I shall be reading bits of Yeats from time to time, and I apologise in advance for the strange things that will happen to my voice when I do that. But before I do that, I just wanted to, in a way, start off by asking Geoffrey a little about the notion of revision and whether how many good poets have been consistent or prolific self-revisers. It strikes me there are very few, but I wonder, Geoffrey, what you think.
I can. Can you hear this? I can think off the top of my head of two or three, and all of them disastrous. A very fine American poet called John Crow Ransom, of whom I'd be very surprised if many people here had heard, because like another fine poet, Alan Tate, he has been rather written out of contemporary American literary history, because as Southern agrarians, they held views on the black-white relationship, which is not well regarded now. In old age, he rewrote nearly every poem in his relatively small oeuvre and ruined it. And he revised, he thought, in the interests of some kind of moral integrity. Beware any poet when he or she revises on the grounds of moral integrity. I think it's generally agreed that Ransom's rewritings are appalling and should simply be ignored. If you read Ransom, and I hope you will, read his poems as they were originally published in the 1920s, 1930s. Auden rewrote disastrously. That very famous poem, September 1st, 1939, which originally contained the line, "We must love one another or die." He wrote that out of the revised poem, saying, incomprehensibly to me, "But we must love one another and die." Therefore implying that again he was guilty of some kind of moral imaginative failure to perceive the obvious. But he was perfectly correct to say we must love one another or die, because he meant die spiritually, die emotionally. He's saying that if we don't love, then we are dead in spirit. And that seems to me an entirely acceptable sentiment. and no reason at all to take the line out and drastically reduce the poem. One other example I can think of, Marianne Moore. Again, I mean, looking at the response, I get the impression that she is not a poet you now widely read over your evening cocoa, but a very fine one. Elizabeth Bishop, whose name you will know, was greatly inspired by her, by a personal friendship and by the example of Moore's poetry. Marianne Moore wrote in her relative youth, early middle age, a poem called Poetry, beginning, "I too dislike it, things important beyond all this fiddle," and it went on, expanded into several stanzas. In her collected poems, that poem is reduced to one line. Again, monstrous misjudgment. Yeats is the only poet I can think of, and of course my memory is fallible. Yeats is the only poet I can think of who can be applauded on some, though not all, of his rewritings. And whereas Moore, Auden, and Ransom rewrote out of some sense of guilt, entirely unnecessary guilt, in my view, Yeats rewrote for quite different reasons. I've been reading recently some of those wonderful little tracts he brought out with the Koala Press, which I would strongly recommend any student of Yeats to try to get hold of. A Package for Ezra Pound is one I've been reading very recently. Passages from a Diary Kept in 1930 is another that I've been reading very recently. And it's quite clear that for Yeats, rewriting was a commitment to something beyond the self. Of course, it included the self, but it really turned on philosophical issues. How does the individual voice integrate itself with the larger community? I was looking through this, expecting to find a poem that is, in fact, not here, but which is very pertinent to our conversation and our discussion. The friends who have it, I do wrong whenever I
remake
a song, should know what issue is at stake. It is myself that I remake. But that myself, that remaking of the self, again, is a quite different thing from the desperate scrabbling to fudge the evidence, which is so painful in Moore and Auden and Ransom. It is something to do with the necessity to turn the private figure into the public statement.
Only remark on that quatrain
is that it's so obvious you didn't think it necessary to print
not
it.
Quite, but that it carries ironies too.
Yes.
In that it is it was printed just the once. It was printed in 1908.
And then in the collected, obviously.
It's in the Variorum edition.
Is it in the Variorum? Ah.
But it is not in any of Yeats's own subsequent collected.
Yes, I had slipped my mind.
But in a way, the irony gets richer or stranger, because he wrote another quatrain, which, if you look at the 1908 Stratford collected by Bullen.
Bullen.
If you look at that, there's a volume devoted to the first ever Yeats bibliography, which is the concluding volume.
Was that Bullen?
It's in the Bullen edition.
But who did the bibliography?
It is the man who finally did the letters.
Oh, yes, Alan Wade?
That's right. It's a young Alan Wade. And, of course, that bibliography contains the evidence, if you like, of a huge world of scattered and often discarded writings. So Yeats allowed this to happen, blessed it, and then contributed a quatrain in preface to that bibliography, which goes, "Accursed, who brings to light of day the writings I have cast away, but blessed he that stirs them not and lets the kind worm take the lot."
It's a bit like Shakespeare's epitaph.
It's in it's entirely it? it's a Stratford edition, of course.
Yes, of course.
But I confess, I become dizzy as I contemplate the ironies of this, because this too was never reprinted.
No, I certainly this is the first time I've heard that.
So, by what right then are we stirring it? No. Is the interdiction's force lessened or not by this? And I don't know the answer.
No.
But yes, it is Shakespearean.
It
indeed,
is, yeah.
And designedly so.
Yeah.
And Geoffrey, you were talking about self and how complicated self is in the remaking.
Yes.
And of course, Yeats was given to saying the occasional thing about this. Yeats's most successful book was not as one might think, you know, The Tower or The Winding Stair, but commercially the successful book was a book called Poems, which first appeared in 1895, but went into numerous editions all the way through to the late 20s. And each time it would go into a new edition, it would be in danger of receiving further revisions, mm-hmm. textually, mm-hmm. Or indeed further prefaces, altered prefaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of these are fascinating. He says, I think it's as early as 1899, and remember, this is a very young poet. This is a man who was born 1865. In 1865,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, he speaks of himself in the third person. Says the writer revised and to a great extent rewrote The Wanderings of a Sheen and certain lyrics and ballads from the same volume. And he has still further revised these and other poems in the present edition. Having said that, he adds a promissory or a threatening note and says other revisions are necessary. And he hopes to make them when... But this is what interests me. He hopes to make them when he is further from the mood in which the poems were written.
Very important. It's a very, very important phrase.
Further from the mood.
And, in fact, an entire course of lectures could burgeon from that one sentence.
Mm.
Because it immediately brings into confrontation a popular sense of what the function of poetry is, and the poet's own growing sense as he thinks about his earth, the poet's own growing sense that there will be an inevitable diremption sooner or later, and sooner probably rather than later, between the popular assumption of what the function of poetry is and his own sense of what the purpose of poetry is.
Yeah.
And the purpose becomes even more polemical as he goes on. But I immediately want to say, it'd be so easy to be misunderstood in one's use of that word polemical. The great triumph of Yeats is to be simultaneously highly polemical and heartbreakingly lyrical.
Mm.
Within three or four lines. Mm. Whereas even with a young poet I admire, that is to say, the young W. H. Auden, or the early middle aged Auden, the lyricism and the politics don't always go together quite as effectively as they do in Yeats. I mean, you have the wonderful, you have the wonderful personal lyrics, "Lay you sleeping head, my love, human on my faithless arm," and you know, you have polemic, but not seen as part of the inevitable complex of an intelligent human being situated in the early and middle years of the 20th century. Having said that, I see that you have printed a poem on the back, which I think is one of the least effective of Yeats's poems.
Politics, this is.
I yield. You know, I revere Yeats. I think of all the 20th century poets writing in English, he is perhaps the greatest. But if I have a few Yeats poems, I care less about it. This one.
Yeah, and we might. I hesitate to say that's why it's there, but that's why it's there, in a way, because I thought we might approach that later. But just to stay on this, before we move into some of these poems, just to stay on the subject of revisions, Yeats could in public say interesting things like this. I mean, that book, Poems, goes on to 1912. By the time of the 1912 edition, he says, "I have," as though an apology, "I have not again retouched the lyric poems of my youth, fearing some stupidity in my middle years," which seems to me enormously self-aware.
I don't know.
Fearing some stupidity in my middle years.
It also requires a tremendous amount of self-confidence to say that, of course.
Yes.
You only say things like that when you know you've got the audience eating out of your hand.
That's right. He carries on, though. I mean, as the years go by, and I suppose as he moves out of his middle years, so that by 1927, he's saying this volume contains what is, I hope, the final text of the poems of my youth. And yet it may not be, seeing that in it are not only the revisions from my book published last year, but quite new revisions on which my heart is greatly set. One is always cutting out the dead wood.
Hardy says things not unlike that, you know. I mean, Hardy writes little prefaces to the three late volumes. Each has an interesting preface, if I remember rightly. And Hardy says things like, I'm coming to the end of, quite clearly coming to the end of my writing life, and as I look back, etc., etc. It's not that kind of preface where your modesty at the same time implies that you know you're a kind of national figure or international figure. Yeats does it very well, but it's not unique to Yeats.
I wonder, though, about the metaphor, the dead wood. I mean, that's to say one can push it a bit. Is this dead wood that once was living? Is Yeats contemplating? He keeps using this phrase, "the poems of my youth." Is he contemplating poetry that was living and is now something other than living?
Living under a different dispensation, I would have thought. Yeats is very conscious of moving into and under a new dispensation. I think in the middle, poetry. He raises questions in the notes from the 1930 diary, which I refer to because I just happen to have read it fairly recently. He talks there about the problem of grafting, intergrafting the personal and the public voice. How to make the voice public without losing its individual validity and resonance. And I mean, what is more interesting for us, I think, is to consider how Yeats in the 1930s could unblushingly produce those marching songs for O'Duffy's Blue yep. Shirts, really rather unpleasant rant, alongside some of the greatest of the late poems, where the rant is understood as part of the dramatic voice, and where the almost the grotesquerie. Do you remember the opening lines of the poem that grew out of Yeats's dislike of the statue of Cahoolan in the post office? That strange way he brings this mundane word post office.
Yes.
What moved through the post office?
Yes.
Where the grotesquerie of that phrase, of course, makes tremendous sense only if you know of the fact that the post office was the beleaguered headquarters of the Republicans in 1916, and that it was chosen as a site for this memorial statue to the Rising, the Cahoolan statue, which Yeats has very mixed feelings about. Where have I got to this point?
A statue's there, he says,
yes,
at one point,
yeah,
to mark the place.
By
Oliver Shepherd, done.
Yes.
But there's a payoff.
Yes.
So ends the tale.
Yes.
The harlot sang to the beggar man.
Yes, yes. The tremendous use of refrain there, and the appalling use of refrain in the marching songs.
Yeats is a master of refrain, I think, in many ways. But
yes, how early did that begin?
Well, repetitions begin pretty early.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure whether
that
catches what's going on later on in the 30s.
No.
Daybreak and a candle end,
yeah,
for example,
yeah,
is almost an anti-balladic feature, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And yet, in a strange way, the most memorable poetic event in that particular
yes,
poem.
Yes.
I threatened earlier on that we might look at a couple of poems,
mm-hmm,
which we shall. And because what I want to do is to focus on what has, I suppose, become a locus classicus for Yeats and revision, which is the revision of his short poem, The Sorrow of Love. Which exists in many more states than the two I have put there. But those are the two long-running states of that poem. And if time permits afterwards, I think I want to refer back to Adam's Curse. But The Sorrow of Love couldn't, in a way, have begun more personally as a piece of writing. That's to say, it's the first evidence we have of this poem is in a vellum-bound manuscript
presented to Maud Gonne
herself, mm-hmm, with the wonderful title given to it by Yeats of The Flame of the Spirit. It's one of a dozen or so poet lyrics there. And there are a few differences, but that's where it starts.
Yeah.
It is published in his book of the following year, The Countess Kathleen, and various legends and lyrics. And there are tinkerings, small tinkerings with it, in 1899 again. But there it sleeps until 1924, when Yeats is revising his work for early poems and stories, when he suddenly lays into this poem again. He says And he's at Cool Park, by the way, when all this is happening. And he writes to his wife, George, in November. He says, I've worked very hard. I've just turned an absurd old poem of mine called The Sorrow of Love into a finer thing. I suppose I would want to listen quite closely to that word absurd and to reflect that writing that to one's wife about a poem written really to the love of one's life is an interesting thing in itself and suggests we might be on delicate
territory. How else would one introduce the subject to one's wife?
Well, quite absurd. An absurd old poem of mine.
Yes. Ha, ha, yes,
well, he does this. Yeah. And bear in mind, Yeats is staying with another woman who took great care of him, Augusta, Lady Gregory,
at this time. Indeed.
Yeah. And we have two copies of her... of Yeats's poems, 1895 and 99, where he has slipped in, tipped in, as the bibliographers say, the revisions to this poem.
Mm.
And he's written very carefully, Made at Cool. Anyhow, this appears the following year in the radically changed version, which I put at the bottom of the sheet there. And no sooner does that book appear, Early Poems and Stories, then W.B. sends it off as a gift to Maud. And he writes, My dear Maud, I send you a copy of my latest book, Early Poems and Stories, all work you know or think you know. Some of the poems, however, have nothing of their old selves but the titles. I am especially pleased with that on page 117, which I should say is The Sorrow of Love. You may perhaps recognise the model for that particular portrait. I felt as I wrote that I had recalled the exact impression of that time and that I had seen it at last, as I could not when I was young, and dimmed the window glass with my hot breath. It's a wonderful letter.
Yes. He talks about Keats, doesn't he? Some
I see a schoolboy when I think of him with face and nose as it pressed to a sweet shop window.
Mm.
He'd written that some time earlier. Yeah. Dimmed the window glass with my hot breath. Yet the implication seems to be, and this I find problematic, that Yeats is now writing the poem which is truer to that moment of frustrated love in his youth than the 1891 thing itself.
Difficult to say.
Mm.
Very difficult to say. And I have to say that in the rewritten version of 1925, as I look at it, I think, introduces what is for me a characteristic weakness of the later Yeats.
Mm.
That is the use of the word that. He does it in that beautiful lullaby, to that great Paris when he found, I can't quote anymore, but do you know the poem I'm referring to?
Mock Emmett, Mock Parnell, all that renown that fell.
That renown. And I think, am I right? You're the expert on this. I believe that Yeats fiddled with that great. Didn't he change it to mighty at one point? To mighty Paris?
Yes, I believe.
As though he himself recognized that he was far too fond of the demonstrative that, which implies, of course, a degree of impact, of sensuous impact, which is no more than an implication.
It's vulnerable, isn't it, to a kind of mistaking in the reader Or a line like, all that lamentation of the leaves is vulnerable to the retort, oh, that lamentation.
Not the other
lamentation. Not the other lamentation.
Not last week's lamentation. Yeah. Not the,
Oh, this is a stylistic point, if you will, but it's important.
Well, stylistic points are always more than stylistic points.
Indeed. In Yeats above all.
In Yeats above all.
Yes.
And very badly so in Eliot's Four Quartets, where Eliot rubs in the stylistic point all the time. That was a way of putting it.
Not very
satisfactory.
Mm. Yes, yes.
No.
I agree. But if one were to take the two poems, I mean, it seems to me that they are different poems at some level, each with its weaknesses, perhaps. But if one were to take them together, I'm not sure that one can quite agree with Yeats that what's going on here is an always more perfect reapproach to a moment that in time that has gone. Think of this. Would you mind dreadfully if I read these two?
I couldn't possibly have the slightest objection with you.
Marvellous timing. I shall read The Sorrow of Love in as 90s-ish a way.
Read it as Yeats.
No, I cannot do that. I shall be carried out. But The Sorrow of Love begins in this incarnation. The quarrel of the sparrows in the eaves, the full round moon and the star-laden sky, and the loud song of the ever-singing leaves have hid away earth's old and weary cry. And then you came with those red, mournful lips, and with you came the whole of the world's tears and all the sorrows of her labouring ships and all the burden of her myriad years. And now the sparrows warring in the eaves, the crumbling moon, the white stars in the sky, and the loud chanting of the unquiet leaves are shaken with earth's old and weary cry. Having read it, I wonder, are there good reasons at all to change it?
I am beginning somewhat perversely to think that it should probably ought to have been left. When you revise, the very act of revision implies that you have a perspective on what you had done. The great peril in having any kind of perspective is that it may carry with it a certain kind of knowingness. I had, up until 20 minutes ago, thought that probably this was a legitimate rewriting. As I've looked at it more and more, and as we've discussed it, and as my mind has focused on, say, the use of that, I wonder, is to what extent is A Girl Arose That Had Red Mournful Lips an improvement morally or technically on And Then You Came With Those Red Mournful Lips?
Well, let's keep it technical. And I think technically it is not an improvement in that A Rose, again, is vulnerable to obtuse reading.
Mm-hmm.
A rose, as one might arise from a table?
Ah, right, got it.
A rose to get out? Yes. But of course, fact, the diction is being pumped up. It's being pumped up artificially here by the notion that something might arise within a historical cycle.
Yes.
I can't, off the top of my head, say give you the references, but Yeats is keen on great momentous things that must arise in time.
Yes.
A Gala Rose. It seems to me a palpably, in fact, a loss compared to... And then you came. Where the pitch of you, I think, is quite precise.
Well...
You are Maud.
Yes. Well, I think the point is, and then you came with those red mournful lips, is not terribly good, but is a Girl Arose that had red mournful lips any better?
I mean, I suppose both are, again, are vulnerable, as though he were to the misconstruction that he's complaining about Maud's makeup being a bit much. Oh, those red mournful lips. Interestingly, in Flame of the Spirit, his pen slips. This is a fair copy, remember, that he's making. But as he makes it, the pen slips. And instead of writing lips, he writes mouth. Has to cross it out and write over the lips. But what I'm driving at here, Geoffrey, is that as a love poem, it seems to me it's a stronger love poem for not being... about Helen of Troy, let's say.
Yes.
Yeats would have replied that it was Marlowe who had given the love poet the eternal right to identify the beloved with Helen of Troy.
But you could say also that Marlowe gave Ancient Pistol the right to his particular rhetoric. Poets have got to be very careful, I think, in claiming that some predecessor has given them the right to say something. You get into the most frightful trouble.
There are voices far back in this 1890s poem, which I dare say weren't really audible to Yeats as he wrote, but they're there. I mean,
Dowson.
But these sparrows in the eaves. You know, one poem that the adolescent Yeats devoured and indeed redevoured later was William Morris's "The Earthly Paradise," mm-hmm. tremendously important poem for Yeats.
Yeah.
And there we have verses like, "Then round he gazed, oppressed with awe, and there no living thing he saw, except the sparrows in the eaves, as restless as light autumn leaves, blown by the fitful rainy wind." There is no question, it seems to me, there is no question of conscious allusion.
No, just here. Absorbed.
Yeah. But here is an element that has been perfectly absorbed by the young poet.
Mm.
And there are other things too. There's a bit of Coleridge, I think, is there. Answer to a child's question. Because do you ask what the birds say? The sparrow, the dove, the linnet and thrush say, "I love and I love." In the winter they're silent. The wind is so strong. What it says, I don't know. But it sings a loud song. That's Coleridge.
I was astonished in reading the Leaves from a Diary kept in 1930. Mm. I was astonished by the emphasis, the importance that Yeats gives to Coleridge in that diary.
Mm.
So I can well believe that you feel you've traced possibly some minor Coleridge in some minor Yeats.
The difference is, though, that come... It is Earth's old and weary cry which I think to the older Yeats is sounding a false note, partly because he was so distrustful of his younger self affecting the old and weary.
Yes, but when you change that to compose, you're playing very prettily with an ambiguity. Compose meaning to make up, and compose meaning to calm down or set in order. And the superiority, if you like, of the final line of the 1925 version, could but compose man's image and his cry, gives certain hostages to fortune. And if we want to start talking about protective mannerism, redefining or re-establishing an image to suit a more epic vision of the relationship of the individual poet to his society, then it leaves somebody, it leaves someone tetchy like myself, to draw attention to the fact that compose is beautifully ambivalent, and can refer to the act of writing as much as to the settling of the emotions. I mean, compose is a kind of ambiguity I would use myself. Therefore, it can't be good. I'm sure I have used it because it is so. It's such a gift to a poet. Compose.
Yes. Half the work is done already. Then
half the work is done already. Compose being that which you are describing as regulating its emotions, and compose as to what you're doing in organizing it. Somebody ought to do a doctorate on uses of the word compose in English poetry. They probably have.
But in the last century, I think. The other element of inflation, is that second stanza, and all the work it tries to do. Seemed the greatness of the world in tears. What's happened there? There are many changes. One of the changes is that we've moved to a more regularly iambic line. If you compare it with the interesting rhythmic effect in the 90s, and with you came the whole of the world's tears. Yeah. And in fact, the stressing of you there would be a question.
Yes.
It's a decision that someone reading the poem aloud needs to make. And with you came the whole of the world's tears. And seemed the greatness of the world in tears.
Yes.
Now, we're in a different rhythmic world here as well.
Yeah.
Then, doomed like Odysseus, and the labouring ships, and proud as Priam, murdered with his peers. Here, perhaps the longer you look at this, the less... it is impressive, but perhaps in the long run not so satisfactory. That I've been trying to work out whether Priam might properly be said to have had peers, and I don't think so. Which makes me think that peers is a word that is there for the sake of rhyme.
It has been known.
It has been known.
And in Book Two of the Aeneid, Priam puts on his armour and goes out to die alone among his enemies. And I cannot conceive that enemies would be described as peers.
As peers.
So how do we get from Virgil's Priam, described very, very pitifully as the old man, creakily getting into his armour and pitifully going out and dying alone? How do you get from that to peers? I don't know.
There is an alliterative richness which is perhaps over-richness too, isn't there? Proud as Priam.
Proud as Priam, peers, people.
And doomed like Odysseus has that alliterative beat to it as well. Yeah, doomed like Odysseus and the labouring ships. Now, I can see that Odysseus is doomed to wander for 10 years. But he will come home.
Yeah.
The labouring ships won't come home.
No.
So they are not doomed in exactly the same way.
Labouring ships is good.
Yes.
I think labouring is a very good epithet with ships at that point, because they are labouring through the oceans. They are, as it were, bearing, they're labouring under the burden of the immediate demands placed upon them. They're labouring on behalf of epic history. No, I would be quite pleased if I had hit on labouring to go with ships.
This is interesting, isn't it? That Yeats, I agree with you that labouring is the best word here, and the most suggestive in many ways. But it is carried over. It is carried over from the early 90s version.
Yes,
and all
so
the
is,
sorrows
so
of her labouring ships.
Absolutely.
Now, in the meantime,
in
the meantime, we find Yeats, in fact, trying out other words.
Well, you've seen the manuscript.
So that if we go to those books in Cool that he was scribbling into in Cool Park, we have different tries at this. A girl swept by with her red mournful lips, swept by is, I think, a real weakness, but a girl swept by with her red mournful lips and seemed the greatness of the world in tears, mourning Odysseus and his scattered ships, or mourning Priam, dead among his peers. Those two lines are then immediately struck out, doomed like Odysseus, and his scattered ships, and proud as Priam, murdered with his peers.
It's interesting that it's the ships which seems to attract the most interesting epithets.
So scattered.
Scattered.
They are scattered.
Yeah, scattered is good.
They and in another draft they are hurricane driven.
No, I don't care for that.
No. But back he goes to labouring.
I mean, both scattered and labouring are both good. I mean, I would expect to find either word in a poem by a young contemporary poet whom I felt able to admire or encourage.
They'd have no time for labouring.
What, the young poet would have no time for labouring?
I think it has negative connotations, hasn't it? Hard work. Possibly fruitless. But more seriously, labouring is a great... the difficulty with labouring, I suppose, now, would be that labouring has Yeats's fingerprints all over it. It's a great Yeats word in many ways.
How does any poet of any stature avoid writing poems without his... or her fingerprints over certain words? What about Baudelaire? Talk about fingerprint words in poetry. Baudelaire, absolutely chock-a-block with fingerprint words. To the ultimate detriment, I think. One of the reasons why I don't admire Baudelaire quite as much as I admire Rambo. Is that Baudelaire's poems are full of Baudelairean words, and I don't think that Rambo's poems are full of Rambodian words in quite that way. Milton's poems are full of Miltonic words. But are Shakespeare's plays full of Shakespearean words? Not necessarily. We're either opening the tomb of the Great Pyramid or a can of worms, and I'm not quite sure which it is.
I don't want to move from labouring, because
we won't.
Let's not.
Let's not.
I am labouring the point, am I not? And yes. There is another aspect
as is
to labouring.
As is Yeats, in a way.
Yeah.
Labouring the point that it... No, he had it in the first version.
The labouring ships
had it in the first version.
Is richer,
yeah.
I'd say, even than scattered.
Though scattered is good. Scattered
it's good,
is not
but telling you
bad.
Too much.
Not at all bad.
Labour. I mean, labour seems to me so richly suggestive of a concept for Yeats, because it need not imply success.
Does it, remind me, does it come into Among School Children?
Yes.
Labour. It comes into the last stanza, doesn't it?
Blossoming or Dancing,
yeah,
where the body is not bruised to pleasure soul. Labour is a blossoming or dancing.
Yes.
Where the body is not bruised to pleasure soul.
A magnificent use of the word.
Yes.
Which is not to be spoiled for us by our subsequent knowledge that it is a word he has fiddled with previously.
He's done, I think, more than fiddle with it, though, previously.
Yeah.
I think it's been wonderfully used.
Yes.
By a younger man writing poems, which brings me, this sounds hideously contrived, forgive me, which brings me to Adam's Curse.
But just one moment, what's the date of Among School Children?
Among School, someone will raise a paw and tell me.
35?
35?
60-year-old smiling
public
man.
It would be, wouldn't it?
Yes,
you're quite right. It has to be,
This is a poem. One must be very careful about sending questions to Among School Children to an audience, I know, because there was a famous occasion in Sligo when a little old lady came to the front, I've been told, and said, "I was one of the girls at the school when Senator Yeats visited." And that more or less trumped whatever anyone
absolutely.
Else had to say.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Yes.
And was, I'm sure, true.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
But labouring, for Yeats, labour and labouring are words that include both the feminine and the masculine notions of labour.
Yep.
And that would be true of Among School Children, but it's true much, much earlier in Adam's Curse, which I'm going to try everyone's patience, probably beyond breaking point, once again by reading, partly because it is, Geoffrey, a poem where I've often, in reading it, thought I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Really. Well, it's a poem until now I've somehow overlooked. So anything that I say will be just a spontaneous response to what is in effect a first reading. I don't know, but I don't know this. Don't know this poem.
This is a poem that is first published.
I may have lectured on it, but I don't know.
It's first published ten years odd, give or take a while, after the Sorrow of Love. Mm. And the key elements are here. There is a moon image, which is similarly important. Mm-hmm. And there is love. There is indeed a kind of question of what eros might be in poetic labour. Mm-hmm. And the notion of men's and women's work. I've printed it out here in a rather strangely punctuated form, you will notice, from the monthly, its first publication, at the end of 1902. And there are some verbal changes, too, which those of you who know Yeats might note here. He smoothed it out a little later. Adam's Curse. "We sat together at one summer's end, that beautiful mild woman, your close friend, and you and I, and talked of poetry. I said a line will take us hours, maybe, yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Better go down upon your marrow bones and scrub a kitchen pavement, or break stones like an old pauper in all kinds of weather. For to articulate sweet sounds together is to work harder than all these, and yet be thought an idler by the noisy set of bankers, schoolmasters, and clergymen the martyrs call the world. That woman then murmured with her young voice, for whose mild sake there's many a one shall find out all heartache in finding that it's young and mild and low. There is one thing that all we women know, although we never heard of it at school, that we must labour to be beautiful. I said, it's certain there is no fine thing since Adam's fall but needs much labouring. There have been lovers who thought love should be so much compounded of high courtesy that they would sigh and quote with learned looks precedents out of beautiful old books. Yet now it seems an idle trade enough. We sat grown quiet at the name of love. We saw the last embers of daylight die, and in the trembling blue-green of the sky, a moon worn as if it had been a shell washed by time's waters as they rose and fell about the stars and broke in days and years. I had a thought for no one but your ears, that you were beautiful, and that I strove to love you in the old high way of love. That it had all seemed happy, and yet we'd grown as weary-hearted as that hollow moon. Will it do?
Utterly, utterly dreary rhymes. Appallingly dreary. The labouring here, to me, is somehow symptomatic of his labouring rhyme. It is, I'm afraid, a most appallingly tedious poem.
Really?
Yes.
I want to know more. Marrow bones, stones.
Oh, they're yes. I mean, you can see how later on Parnell came down the road. He said to a cheering man, "Ireland shall gain her freedom, and you still break stone." The late Yeats is very effectively always going down his marrow bones and writing about stones. Yes, sure. There is an embryonic effective rhetoric here to be whatever you do with an embryo, it grows, doesn't it? That will perhaps, I don't mean embryonic, that sounds too organic. It's got to be a word more suggestive of mechanical lifting out than the development of an embryo, because I don't think this develops. I don't think it can in itself develop into the later Yeats. Certain images, certain rhyme words, focusing on words like bone and stone, are clearly something that Yeats's inner ear holds for later use. But I do think that it is, as it stands, a most dismal piece of work.
Is it then... You see, I would say that this is a poem that's in some relation, some significant relation, not necessarily forwards. We could agree that among school children is somewhere here, but backward, a relation back to the sorrow of love, to words like weary. Maybe in your reading of this as dismal, that we should then return to a word like weary in the sorrow of love and see that it is it is tainted somehow.
Well, as I say, I mean, this is my first this is my first reaction to the poem.
Well, it might have been my reading, Geoffrey.
No, no, your reading was very, very beautiful, very harmonious. It took full account of the stresses and the slacks. I sat here on my... No, not on my...
You're not on your marrow bones.
Not on my
present.
Marrow bones, no. I sat with my marrow bones creaking or whatever. Yes. And thought, I wish I could do
this. Now, one could, of course, become dreadfully solemn about a poem like this and hold forth at great length about its negotiation. If that's the word.
That's an in word. Negotiation.
I was hoping you'd hear my inverted comma.
Yes, I did. Very, very clearly.
Of the gender issues involved.
Negotiation,
Bear
that in mind if you're sitting your finals in a couple of weeks. Negotiation,
Neither negotiate nor renegotiate, if possible. I'm interested in the poem in a way because it does go on so long and it manages to avoid so many tricky areas. That's to say, there is a social awkwardness, shall I say? Yes, awkwardness about what this poem tries to provide with a smooth covering. The awkwardness is to do with the male poet feeling simultaneous attraction to both you and your friend and having somehow to align this decorously with talk of poetry. And the middle ground here is this concept, labour.
Eliot does it much better in Portrait of a Lady. There is also a very significant difference between awkwardness and gaucheness. You want it to be awkwardness, I want it to be gaucheness. Or you could turn on me again and say, oh, well, Eliot is... Yeats is writing a deliberately awkward poem about gaucheness. And we could, we could go on for the length of a seminar. But I would say what troubles me here is not so much awkward. Awkwardness is fine. I mean, we are all awkward. Awkwardness is part of the existential condition, which can be immensely productive. Awkwardness is productive. Gaucheness is sterile. And I think this poem is sort of gauche and sterile, not awkward and productive. But this is the first time I've read it, First time I've had it read. This is Hill at his viva. Though at my viva, I. Chaired by J.R.R. Tolkien, I'll have you know. At my viva, I was tested on Ode to a Nightingale. And I was asked, wouldn't it have been much better if Keats had stopped the ode one stanza before the end? And I said, absolutely not. That the final stanza is utterly, utterly, utterly necessary for the strength of that poem. I'm doing a kind of viva on this. I just hope that I will dazzle you with superficialities.
We must be winding up this particular conversation. I think. And I think I'm fascinated by the gauche and awkward distinction. And I shan't be launching a last ditch at defence of politics, by the way, in case anyone's wondering. Merely to say that there is proof at least that the old man can be as gauche as the young.
Yes.
I take it you see it that way.
Yes, I do see it that way. I would point out that I have now outlived Yeats.
Yeah.
So I can...
Yes.
And there are lessons to be learned.
Mm.
As they say in government.
Good.
And as the Met always has it, terrible things have happened, but lessons have been learned.
Yes, indeed.
Well, terrible things have happened in the past hour, but lessons have been learned.
Lessons, I'm sure, have been learned. And I shall conclude simply, or as simply as one can conclude, by thanking Geoffrey for agreeing to a moderate grilling.
I think I was utterly crazy to do so, but
thank you. For sending
up.
Yes, many things, but sending also me back to certain questions in Yeats that are hard to resolve.
Very, very, very hard to resolve.
I guess I would say that he's one of the very few poets, very few, for whom it's worth taking trouble of that kind.
Well, I think contemporary poetry ought to be more like texting myself.
I was hoping you'd say that. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this conversation today. Thanks very much.